were here on Tuesday? So a good percentage. Okay. For those who weren't, we left off by talking about the asylum process in the United States and kind of the ways that it doesn't always strictly fit with the definition that was laid out in the 1951 Refugee Convention. So we'll finish up kind of a historical conversation on that. And then what I thought we would do is I looked back at the questions that you all posed at the beginning of the session on Tuesday, the little ones that, which are more like, can you find an answer for this if you, you know, do a long enough Google search, or if you go to Wikipedia, or if you talk to enough people, and addressing questions particularly about conflicting viewpoints or multiple viewpoints, as well as detention. And then we'll transition, hopefully by the end of today, to kind of addressing the bigger questions, for which I don't have any particular answers, and I don't suspect any one of us do either. But there's a few ways that I would suggest a framework for kind of thinking about how to continually respond to this issue as it comes up in our communities, our places of worship, our schools, and so on. So I've had this statistic up for a little while, but essentially, as just a very brief recap, the asylum process is a very political one based on countries of origin and how our particular government gets along with or agrees with a country and whether or not we want to suggest that we want to give protection to their citizens or not, if you have access to a lawyer, and if you're detained while fighting asylum, or if you're outside of it. And then recently, of course, the decision by Attorney General Sessions to overturn asylum protections for people fleeing domestic or gang violence. So I think for a lot of you who are members of faith traditions or faith communities, you may already be part of sanctuary movements in your own churches, or have heard of the historical sanctuary movement that emerged in the 1980s. Have any of you heard from or met John Fife from Southside Presbyterian? All right, a handful of you. Yeah. Yeah, I want to say what you know about him or what you heard.
He's a former moderator as a Presbyterian of the PCUSA. Uh-huh. Works very closely with the sanctuary movement.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So there were, you know, maybe 20 to 25 very active members of the sanctuary movement that originated at Southside in Tucson, which was in the 1980s a movement to bring people up from Central America, where our government was supporting the military governments and were not getting asylum as a result, to lead them to safety in the United States. John Fife is a very charismatic fellow, and he's kind of seen as the figurehead of it. And I represent his words here because he is the best known, perhaps, but there's a lot of people, a lot of women in particular, whose voices don't get heard quite as much. So while he is sort of seen as the founder and one of the main leaders, it's important, too, to remember that there are many voices that were represented in that. So I just pulled out a quote that kind of speaks to the historical sanctuary movement and how it very much parallels sort of what we're seeing today with asylum grant rates, and how it ties then into sort of faith traditions of sanctuary. So he says, "There is always in United States refugee policy a politicized difference. Hockey players coming from Czechoslovakia had no trouble getting political asylum. People fleeing Nicaragua," which again was a country that tended more towards the communist side of things, so we gave them asylum at a much higher rate, were recognized as political refugees during that time. People fleeing Cuba, similar story, were of course recognized immediately, but anyone from El Salvador or Guatemala was immediately deported and no one was being given political asylum. The official policy of the United States was that we were in support of the military of those countries under the theory that we were bringing democracy and freedom to those countries. So we could scarcely acknowledge that the guys we were supporting and training were running the death squads and were primarily responsible for the repression there. We could scarcely acknowledge that the people who were fleeing were refugees. The official policy of the United States Department was that these people were economic migrants. They weren't fleeing death squads and torture and repression. And some of the specifics have changed a little bit today. Like, there's not an active war going on between guerrillas and the government. But I think if you substitute some of the, you know, country names or gang violence or, you know, police corruption or whatever, it's exactly the same story as what we're seeing today. And then he goes on to say this. And does somebody want to read this out loud?
"I was the pastor of a church, and as such, I had the responsibility to tell people, one, the truth, and two, to provide some ethical and moral guidance for them. I just stated then there are gross violations of human rights going on by our government against people who are absolutely defenseless. When I was a theological student in a seminary in Pittsburgh, I had these old German theologians who were my professors, and they used to tell stories about Germany in the 1930s and 40s. In the confessing church there, in the Holocaust, and that they would say to us, "Don't you ever forget that, remember." And I would nod off and say, "Why don't these guys talk about something that is relevant? I'm going to be a pastor in a Presbyterian church in North America, and this has no meaning for me at all." And then suddenly I found that old voice haunting my conscience. It's important that we remember all...
Jeez. I don't know why I always do that.
Remember all of these instances in which human rights and civil rights had to be defended. And that is always has involved some risk. You never get a free ride in the terms of the defense of civil and human rights.
Yeah.
Reverend John Fife.
So I just wanted to kind of include that as a sort of historical perspective on the sanctuary movement as well as asylum policy.
I just want to offer a holding connection. One of John Fife's pastoral colleagues was Pastor Jim Oinas from a Lutheran church in Tucson, who then came and was Holden's pastor.
Oh, no way. What was his name? Reverend John?
Jim Oinas.
Jim Oinas.
Awesome. Him and his wife, Randy, did quite a bit.
Yeah. Are any of you all involved in sanctuary movements in your own faith communities? Or a few. Wonderful. Yeah. Let's see. There's no one taking a photo. So there are a handful of people who are curious to know about contrasting viewpoints and how they kind of coexist, or, you know, in certain ways don't particularly coexist very well at all. And one of the places I often like to take either visitors or students or whatever is the small community of Arivaca, Arizona. And this is quite a long shot, but has anyone been there before? Yeah, Lisa, okay. Lisa and probably Molly. So it's, I think, kind of a very good case study for what southern Arizona and what much of the borderlands look like in ways that you don't necessarily see in a place like Nogales, which is so predominantly Latino, or in places like Tucson, which is just larger and people don't have to engage quite as much. So Arivaca is a community 10 miles north of the international boundary, quite remote. It's about... From Tucson, it's about an hour and a half drive, just down winding roads, and 700 people. There's one general store, a small gas station, a library, two Baptist churches that were started by brothers who, and they split because they don't get along anymore, and one Catholic church. So it's just kind of this old, like, Wild West frontier town. And this is a photo of what the desert sort of looks like out there. There are lush portions, but that's mostly what it looks like in a group of migrants who's crossing. And this is a fairly typical group size. No one really crosses alone, and no one really crosses without a guide. So who lives in Arivaca? Why is it such an interesting place, at least to me? Well, one, there's a lot of ranchers who live there, and they've been there for generations. A number of the ranchers I know have been there for three or four or five generations and are kind of continuing on that family lineage. They tend, I know perhaps, you know, five or six ranching families there, which comprises, I don't know, maybe 10%, 20% of this town's population. They tend to be more conservative in their views on immigration, favoring the wall, favoring more Border Patrol presence, and favoring, in general, a legal path to citizenship, or that they want people to kind of get in line and do things the quote-unquote right way. In a lot of ways, I understand their perspective based on where they're coming from, because their livelihood depends on this particular feeling of safety, of not having their land be kind of quote-unquote overrun with people who are crossing, with littering, etc. But I do think, like, the narrative that they tell themselves is different than what I see factually emerging. However, it's very difficult to argue with what they feel is happening versus what I know to be happening from a more factual level. So there's that narrative. The other thing I would say about them is that, by and large, they, one, don't call the Border Patrol when they encounter people, just because the response time is very slow. that they're so remote that to call the Border Patrol, the office in Tucson, to get a response, and then someone dispatched out to the remote ranches would take maybe 2 or 3 hours. And most people I know are not comfortable just detaining people while they wait for the Border Patrol to come. It's just, it feels really weird. And the other thing I would say, too, is that I think I mentioned this on Tuesday. They also, for a variety of reasons, humanitarian as well as just logistical, they don't like to find bodies on their land. And so they will often put out, water tanks that have clean water. They will offer food to people, et cetera. So they may have one ideological position, but just because of the fact of their kind of interaction with so many people, they are also providing some sort of humanitarian aid. So a very complicated group, a very complicated group.
The next question about the group. Has any of them said fear of losing their cattle or poaching mm-hmm. or vegetables or crops or any of that kind of stuff? And that's why they're no.
Absolutely.
Wire fences getting cut.
Right. And they definitely do say that. And I think it's mostly because of the fences getting cut, and then also the litter and the cows just like consuming like plastic bags or plastic, et cetera. Yeah. And that, when cattle are going for several thousand dollars a head, like that's a real concern. Absolutely. I don't dismiss that for a second. Yeah. The next group, I don't have much sympathy for. I apologize for my bias already in presenting this. But you can make your own judgment. It's a group called Arizona Border Recon. And they call themselves a vigilante group. And I was doing some reminder reading on this right before I came. And so it's people from around the country who will pay their own way, kind of be lured by this narrative of immigrants are overrunning our country. We need to seal the border, et cetera. So they'll come down to Arivaca or the nearby town of Sasebe for, a week off and patrol the desert. And they will hold people up at gunpoint until the Border Patrol arrives. So they see themselves as, just vigilantes, like filling in where the government and where Border Patrol does not. It should be said that no one in the community, Border Patrol included, particularly appreciates their efforts because the land is so expansive and so vast. There are no checks on their behavior. We have no idea what they're doing out there. And you can go anywhere in this small town of Arivaca and just see, from the cantina to the library to the general store to just like random cars, and almost all of the bumper stickers that you'll see will say no militia. So they're not a particularly welcome presence in town because they do tend to be so far ideologically to the right. You also attract some people who don't, they haven't been particularly well vetted, and I think they're extremely motivated by a particular narrative. And there have been instances of them killing people in town, including a 9-year-old and her father, just entering their houses and then posing death threats to a lot of the people I know, the town librarian, a young humanitarian aid worker, and so on.
The ones that killed the 9-year-old and their father, were they arrested?
They sure were. They sure were. Life sentence, actually. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So there's not a ton of tolerance for the way that they operate. And yet they're still, they come from around the country, and there's this man named Tim Foley who sort of leads them, and he has a Facebook page. There's a really interesting article about them on actually a USA Today report, and he just kind of will bring them down, but no one else particularly favors them. Yeah.
Do they get funded in some way?
They mostly fund themselves. So this is a terrible comparison, and I apologize, but it's kind of like us coming to Holden Village. Like, you have to pay for your lodging, you have to pay for your travel, you have to pay for your food. And then once you're there, they consider it, the people who I've heard interviewed kind of consider it like a vacation in service of some kind of moral vision. Yeah.
Are a lot of them kind of Rambo wannabe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They like their weapons. Everyone there, well, not everyone, but most people in Arivaca like their weapons. Yeah. And then there's a Arizona Border Recon. Just kind of this renegade group. So we've got that in tandem with the ranchers who, I would say are slightly right of center, but do, for the most part, treat immigrants with some degree of kindness and compassion in their everyday interactions. I've met so many people who have, offered them water, food, clothing, a change of clothes, and some guidance on where to go next. And then there are Border Patrol agents. Arivaca is far off the map. And so most people don't particularly, most people who want access to a Safeway or to a movie theater or a doctor's office or whatever probably won't move to Arivaca. And I would say, by and large, most Border Patrol agents fit into that category. They are, however, constantly patrolling the streets of the town. I go there about once or twice a week, and there has never been a time that I haven't seen a Border Patrol agent, and there's even more rarely, but less rarely, but equally often, I don't see people who are not getting apprehended when they're there. So it's just a constant flow of being patrolled, being surveilled, etc. In the 60s, there was a commune that was established there. And so a lot of hippies flocked there to kind of live out their ideological values, to get off the grid, to escape government surveillance. And so they kind of remained there as the commune fell apart. However, they hold on to a lot of their more libertarian values. And in a very cruel twist of fate, they live in one of the most surveilled parts of the country. So there's helicopters, and there's cameras, and there's everyone watching their movements. And so they're an interesting mix, too. They have, like, a nice little artistic co-op and so on. They kind of remind me of some parts of Holden, their store.
This is where you came up.
Gosh. Right,
right. You have a desert, like, where are you?
Yeah.
Katie?
Yeah.
I'm assuming by Border Patrol agents, you're including ICE agents in that.
Yeah, ICE agents don't really come there too much. I mean, there's 700 people in town, and so migrants is the next category. No migrant in their right mind would ever remain there. Yeah, just because it's so small, the factions are so intense, there's no jobs. Like, most people are coming for either to seek economic security or safety, and there's probably not either of those in Arivaca. So it is mostly just Border Patrol agents who are looking for people kind of in transit. Yeah.
Is the commune near town?
It folded. It folded in maybe the late 70s, but it was about 5 miles or maybe 10 miles south of town.
Okay. Yeah. So they've immigrated into town?
Exactly. Okay. Some left and some stayed. Yeah. And then there's snowbirds who come mostly from October and November through May. And they're a really interesting bunch to kind of complicate this whole landscape. Because some are, you know, quite conservative. Some are quite liberal. And so they just sort of come in and out. I think they're seen as having more of an ability to step away. And then, yeah, so they add to the mix in a variety of different ways. And then, yeah, there's migrants who come through all the time. They're just passing through. None really remain there for the reasons just being no jobs and no particular sense of security. And there's a high degree of visibility. It's about 10 miles north of the border, but it's about a 5 to 6 day walk just because you have to go over mountain ranges. Many people are not walking in a straight line. There's no trails. It's bushwhacking. It's hot. The longest I ever encountered, I met two people who had been walking for 18 days to get there. So. And then they still have to get to Tucson or Chicago or Phoenix or Los Angeles or wherever they're going. So it's a long journey. And then the final crew to complicate this mix, and Lisa, you might be able to like elaborate on this, but is this group called People Helping People or No More Deaths. And so they tend to be people in their late teens, 20s, maybe up into their 30s. Mostly straight out of college, mostly privileged, mostly white, who are willing to risk arrest or risk a great degree of, they're willing to put themselves on the line legally in the interest of saving migrant lives or in the interest of keeping people out of the hands of Border Patrol. I would say most are not only of the opinion like, don't build the border wall. It's like no border wall should ever exist. So that in contrast with like the militia group and the ranchers is quite stark. And they don't particularly get along well with other people, but they're a big, big part of town. They're a big part of town. So the thing that they do that I think is really worth pointing out is that with the exception of the Arizona Border Recon and a few ranchers, most people won't call Border Patrol when they encounter a migrant because the process is so extremely, it really complicates the lives of migrants. And again, it feels really strange to detain somebody. So instead of that, if you don't want to take the personal risks yourself of aiding, quote unquote, aiding and abetting a migrant, you can call this local group called People Helping People, and they themselves will assume those risks of transporting people to medical attention or to advising them about what next steps might be, of giving them a space in their house while they rest and recuperate and so on. So they fill a really interesting function there of being this sort of intermediary between people who don't want to call the Border Patrol and also don't want to, take the legal risk themselves of providing humanitarian aid. Yeah.
So then does that small militia group then harass those people?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. There's tons of death threats against them. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
700 people or so. What percentage are each of these groups?
The militia group is tiny, very small. They're very, very unpopular in town. And the rest, I would say it's pretty... Well, pretty equally mixed, although migrants don't live there and Border Patrol agents don't really live there. I'd say of the other four, it's a pretty equal 25%, 20-25%. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Does the militia group threaten those that are trying to help?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a number of friends who work with people helping people, and there's not a single one of them who hasn't gotten a death threat. Huh. Yeah.
Their safe houses that the people have, are they in that community or are they getting out?
They're in the community.
And are they easily identified?
Yeah, they are. They are. I mean, there's, like, right at the people helping people office, there's a safe house, and that's very well known. Yeah. Yeah. The other thing, somebody asked the other day about the differences in the Obama and Trump administration, and that's actually mostly where I have seen it, is in the Obama administration, there was just kind of this blind eye that was turned to humanitarian aid work, and the definition of aiding and abetting was maybe a little bit more ample. In the Trump era, I've seen it get narrower and narrower and narrower, and the No More Deaths camp that existed up until 2017, last summer, which provided a place for people to rest as they were crossing or gave them water, medical attention, meal, et cetera, was shut down by Border Patrol, which had never bothered the camp before. Yeah. The other thing that's interesting is that the No More Deaths camp and the people helping people, their philosophy is that you always follow the lead of the migrant. Like, you present to them the options that are in front of them. So one option could be you're trying to get to Tucson. Like, you know, that's 45 miles up the road. It'll probably take you X number of days to get there. You have to go through two checkpoints, et cetera. So be aware of that. Another would be to, if you don't think you can make it, remember that Mexico is 10 miles south of here, so you can walk yourself back and then you don't have anything on your record. You can rest with people helping people and then continue on your way. Or the last option is, if you want, we can call Border Patrol. And a lot of people will actually choose that option because they don't want to continue to risk their lives. I've had to do that a few times, and one story, like, it really kind of stands out to me. But I was visiting Arivaca with a friend. This was 2012, I believe. And she wanted to take the long road back to Tucson because it was the year anniversary of her encountering a migrant in the desert, encountering a migrant's body. And so she had erected a cross there in his memory. And we drove there. And there was a man just a few yards away from that. And we encountered him and asked his name. And his name was the same name of the person who had passed away there from the same city and the same age. And he was alive. I mean, it was a common name, Jose Rodriguez, and he was from Mexico City. But there was something mysterious and large at work there. And he wanted us to call Border Patrol. So we called and waited for him. And he had just a little bit of like goldfish crackers left. And he shared them with us while we waited for Border Patrol to arrive.
So when you call Border Patrol, does that mean they're asking for asylum?
Is that right? He, in this particular case, he wasn't. They could be asking for asylum. There are generally, usually if you want to ask for asylum, the easiest way to do it is to present at a port of entry, but not all people know that. It could also be, just that they want to turn themselves in and get deported. It's gotten a lot harder, especially in the last month or two, because of zero tolerance policies. That means they're going to have a criminal record if they turn themselves in. Yeah.
Is there much, are there many, I mean, these guys are walking on a trail, are there many of these trails, roads?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're shifting all the time. This is actually not a particularly, I mean, there's been a lot of deaths here, but there haven't been a ton of deaths. Like, this is not actually the most harsh region. It's fairly remote, but it's not the most remote, and there's some cattle tanks, which aren't great to drink out of because they'll give you like diarrhea or vomiting and make you more dehydrated, but there's still water sources, or there's ranches. Whereas on the Oregon Pipe National Monument, which is to the west of there, to the reservation, like, those are just killing fields.
I mean, do Border Patrol agents use this type of trail,
sure,
road to...
Yeah, I've heard said, and I believe it, I don't think there's anyone who crosses into this country without Border Patrol knowing. I mean, there's sensors, there's, you know, ATVs, there's horses. It's just a matter of them, one, I think, being able to catch everyone who comes in, and two, wanting to. And
Do the people helping people to safe houses, do they declare those as sanctuary? Or
I don't think so. I don't think formally. Mm-mm. I think it's very, very under. I mean, because they tend to, most of the people who work there tend to be kind of anarchists and punks. Like, I don't think they affiliate very much with any label or organization. Yeah.
So ICE, I mean, not ICE, but the Border Patrol could clear immunity there and just go after somebody.
They could. You have to have a search. A lot of places in town will have signs that say U.S. Border Patrol, do not enter without a search warrant. And yeah, the sign is pretty ubiquitous.
Okay.
Yeah, libertarians and the humanitarian aid workers alike. So it's kind of interesting because, again, there they meet in a very unlikely way. Those who oppose government intervention and those who, well, I guess they both oppose government intervention, but for very different reasons. Oh, so I was like, I want to make a flowchart for what happens when people get picked up or when they don't. But I don't know how to do it on the computer, and I'm not going to spend my time at Holden Village doing that. So I drew it. So as it's unscientific, but I would say it's true, especially now, for about 90% of the people who come across. So this is only true in the Tucson sector. Every particular sector does it a little bit differently. So you can cross the desert and one of two options happen. You're not apprehended, so you either arrive to your destination or other, which I suppose would mean you go back into Mexico on your own or you die, or those are mostly the options I can think of. Or if you're picked up by Border Patrol, there are generally three things that happen. One, and this hardly ever happens anymore, especially since May of this year with the zero tolerance policy. There's a voluntary return form that you sign, and then you are repatriated. So if you're from Mexico, usually that same day. So it means you get deported, but you don't have any criminal charge on your record. So that is by far and away the best outcome for a lot of people. However, if during that particular process you declare a fear of return, then you will get sent to a detention center to begin the credible fear process and then the asylum process. So you will be transported there if you say you have a fear of returning to your country. And I'll talk more about that in a second. Now, what they're trying to do to everyone is, under the zero tolerance policy, put them through something that's called Operation Streamline. And have any of you who've been to the border witnessed this kind of expedited process? Okay. It's awful. It's awful. So 75 people are sentenced it's either a misdemeanor or a felony, depending on how many times they've crossed, of entry without inspection. And from there, they are sentenced to 0 to 180 days in prison based on a very strained algorithm. So 75 people between 1:30 and 3 o'clock are sentenced. So it's just this mass system of justice. You have 75 people in the room. Until last year, when the Ninth Circuit declared it illegal, they were shackled the whole time. And they had just come out of the desert. There's a lot of problems with the process, and I think one that I could explain most clearly is if you imagined yourself with, I would say, the average level of formal education that a lot of people who are crossing through the desert have is maybe fourth or fifth grade. Not to like generalize, but I would say that's about the average. Some have less, far less, and some have more. A lot of them don't speak English Spanish as their first language. A lot of people are from southern Mexico, Guatemala, where an indigenous language is more common, and they only have Spanish and English interpretation. Another problem is that the legal system here, it doesn't make much sense to me, to someone from another country with a fairly limited level of formal education. It's going to make no sense at all as to how the words felony, misdemeanor, plea agreement, declaration of guilt or whatever mean in those countries. I don't even know. And then to do this within a day or so of getting picked up in the desert when you've been walking for a week in 110 degree temperatures. I mean, there's just like no way they're pleading guilty willingly and knowingly. And that is one question that they're consistently asked. So the comparison I like to make for my students is, imagine you're traveling in Guatemala and you didn't get some kind of paperwork that you were supposed to. And maybe you know that a little bit, but you just were like, And then you get taken to court for it. You're put in shackles. You've been walking. You've been on a long hike. And then the proceeding is conducted in Cockchicao, let's say, in an indigenous language. But they provide interpretation in a second language that you're okay at. Like maybe you're good at French or Spanish or German or whatever, what the case might be. And then they go through the Mayan justice system to arrive there. And you have to plead guilty or not guilty based on that in about 1 minute. So there's no way this is actual justice. The argument for it is just that, one, it's a deterrent effect, and two, that it's a way of kind of criminalizing migration a little bit more, and so that people who go through this will think twice about coming again. So they're sentenced to 0 to 180 days. If it's their first offense, if it's their first time crossing the border, they will be sentenced to time served and then deported that afternoon, usually. If it's their second time crossing, they're usually caught sentenced to 30 days. However, that can be bumped up more if they have any kind of previous record in the U.S., mostly a minor one. It'd be like, you know, a DUI, a traffic violation, et cetera. And then randomly, the sentence will get increased if you were deported previously through California or Texas. And then you'll get 60 days. So it's just this like algorithm that doesn't make sense. Yeah.
So they're deported in the afternoon, which means they're put in a van, driven to the border, and just dumped?
Absolutely.
Out in the middle of the desert? Do they get
in the middle of Nogales. Yeah. So 20,000 or 300,000 people in Nogales.
So to a border crossing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To a city. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, yeah.
Does Mexico, for example, ever say no?
That would be a really interesting question. They never have. They never have. What they do say no to is to non-Mexican citizens, and so that's where things get even a little bit stranger. So we will only deport Mexican citizens that day, and there are a lot of people who aren't from Mexico who are going through Operation Streamline, primarily Central America. They will get sent back to the holding facility where they have to wait for a plane to fill up with people from their country. Not a big deal. I mean, in the scope of things, if you're from Guatemala, you're probably going to be waiting maybe at this point 2 to 3 to 4 days. But there's been a number of like Russians coming through or Bolivians. I mean, those planes have to fill up like once every few months. So then you're sentenced to just that amount of time to wait. So you might have a sentence of time served, but you're actually going to be serving a longer sentence in detention while you wait for people. Yeah, or wait for the plane to fill up.
Yeah. I know a great fear of the Trump administration is that they're getting terrorists coming through these crossings.
Yeah.
Do you see many people from the Middle East that are trying to cross through the border?
Zero, I've seen. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So it's just a...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the ranchers, when they talk, will say, like, that's another reason we have to seal off the border, because we can't tell if this person's Mexican or, you know, from the Middle East, which, I mean, there's a whole load of, like, racism implicit in that. But yeah, no, I've never seen a Middle Easterner. Not, I mean, yeah, never. The furthest I've seen is Russia, maybe a few, and just a few of those. Yeah.
You know, my understanding is that people that immigrate from like Southeast Asia, they fly to Ecuador and they come up the same way.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't see many of them too, but yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah. And so then the last possibility, so you can go through Streamline usually 2 or 3 times, and then you get bumped up to kind of a higher court where you actually have a trial, but you're detained while waiting for the trial, and then you get your sentence, and then you're deported. And the sentence in those cases is quite a bit longer than 180 days. We're talking like years as opposed to months. So the other thing about this is that in any of these stages, voluntary return, you know, if you go through a court or if you go through Operation Streamline, you can always request that credible fear interview, and then you'll be fighting it inside of detention. There was recently, I think it was late February or early March, there was something that had been called the Rodriguez bonds that previously existed, and after 6 months of your sentence in detention, you would be eligible for bond, which is the equivalent of bail in the immigration detention world. And they were set... The lowest I'd ever heard was $1,500, and the highest was maybe $30,000 or $40,000. But if you were able to pay that, then it was kind of this agreement that you had to keep showing up to all of your court hearings, but you could fight your case from outside of detention. They did away with that in February or March. So now, while you're fighting asylum, you are essentially going to be fighting it from detention.
So under Obama, could most of them choose voluntary return?
It was, I mean, I would always ask, yeah, I always asked the judges that who presided over Operation Streamline, who by, like, I've never met a judge who agrees with Operation Streamline, interestingly. I would always ask who gets selected for this, and they said it was random. So they definitely would do some, just like the threat of it being a deterrent effect because you don't know who's going to get picked up. It was started in January 2008, so that's under Bush. Wait, January? Yes, January 2008 was Bush. And then it expanded greatly under Obama. And it now exists. Prior to May of this year, it was mostly active in 3 ports of entry, 2 in Texas and then in Tucson. But now it's expanded to just about everywhere. Yeah. San Diego just started it. Um, Did any of you hear about this case?
Yeah.
The Claudia Yeah. So this was in the Rio Grande Valley. And so she was not, you know, a quote-unquote victim of the desert as a result of walking or natural elements. But she was a 23-year-old from an indigenous village in Guatemala who was crossing the river in South Texas and was killed by a Border Patrol agent, I think about a third of a mile into the United States because they thought she was carrying a blunt object.
A blunt object?
that's what every court document I've read has said. I don't know. I mean, she was shot and killed by a Border Patrol agent. And so this was just, I bring this up just as a reminder of what other kinds of violence can exist in the borderlands, you know, that are more structural, as well as sort of the art that emerges out of a really tragic and unjust event. So this was just created anonymously to honor her memory by an artist. And do you know where am I in the...
No.
Okay. That's right. Yeah, she had left because she couldn't find work in Guatemala and she wanted to return to school and to study. And she just didn't have the funds necessary to pay for it. So she had hoped that finding a job for a few years in the U.S. would provide that. So a lot of people were asking about detention facilities. And this is a photo of the Eloy detention facility it's in between Tucson and Phoenix. And it's where... it's mixed gender. It's women and men who are held there, but most of the men go to Florence. So why do they go to detention? One, because they're considered a flight risk or a danger to society. And then it's also, similarly to Operation Streamline, it's considered a tool of deterrence. If people know that they will be serving sentences in a detention center, the thinking is they may not cross. And like we were talking about on Tuesday, it's kind of that same rationale that, you know, includes sealing off the urban ports of entry and pushing people into the desert, that people in desperate situations won't make those kind of cost-benefit analyses. When the reality is that people who are desperate or fleeing for their lives, like, that's not always going to enter into the equation. So there are, at last count, there are 41,000 detention beds in 209 facilities, with the highest numbers being represented in Texas, in this order. Texas, which has like 15,000, California around maybe 5,000, and then Arizona, Georgia, and Louisiana. 62% are privately owned, mostly by CoreCivic and Geo Group.
And that means what, CoreCivic?
It's just the name of a private prison corporation. Okay. Yeah.
Do you have any idea what kind of profit those private prisons
make? I don't know. That's a really good question.
Well, 150
we make days. Profit because those of us who have thrived.
Oh.
And so I would like, if we have a chance to talk about that here, or maybe at another time while we're here.
Right. That's a really interesting. Yeah.
Massive investments.
Write that down.
Did you repeat that?
Yeah.
She said that those of us who invest in Thrivent have massive investments in, is it CoreCivic or Geo Group? Do you know? Okay.
I don't know enough about it, so I was hoping others would join me.
No, Josh Post is here. Works for Thrivent. He's the board president.
Well,
so he might be.
Great.
Okay. All right. Right. Oh, wow. That'd be awesome. Wow. Cool. Yeah.
Would you say what they said? I didn't hear. Is the board president present?
No, Holden.
Board of Holden.
The board president of Holden is Josh Post.
Oh, okay.
And he works for Thrivent. Okay. One of the things we'll be doing, hopefully a little bit today and certainly on Friday, is kind of action planning. So, yeah, we can maybe bring Josh Post in here.
You may not.
Well, respectfully, yeah.
For those of us who live in Minnesota, ICE is trying to expand and add another detention center in or near St. Paul.
Wow.
Sherburne County is one of the places they're considering.
Private or public? Or
There's been both.
Okay.
And so, like, there have been public jails like Sherburne County that have been interested and have been applying. I don't have a lot of details, but I know it's happening.
While you're at the your yeah. thought. I hope at some point we're going to talk about the issue of, you know, the, like the babies being thrown in the river. We're fishing them out of the river rather than going upstream to try to stop them from being thrown.
Right. Yeah, so kind of like, if I can summarize, like looking at root causes as opposed
yeah,
to, okay,
causes,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
why people are
yeah,
happy,
yeah,
for safety,
yeah,
that their situation could be better in their homes.
Exactly, exactly.
Most of us would not, you know,
exactly.
To lose your culture, your family,
yeah.
your homes.
Have any of you heard of Rebecca, the writer Rebecca Solnit?
Yes.
Okay, she has a beautiful essay called The Right to Stay Home or the Right to Not Migrate, because we often talk about what would it look like to have a world in which everyone is free to migrate, but she flips it on its head and asks, what would it look like if everyone had the right to not migrate, if they had the choice to do so, but if they had the absolute dignity and well-being to remain in their hometowns, which most people prefer, not everyone, as we talked about briefly on Monday with your pairs, like people migrate for all different kinds of reasons, but by and large, people should have the right to remain home or to not migrate. So it's currently costing $150 per day per person to detain individuals in a private facility, which is, again, 62% of these 41,000 beds, versus about $100 or $98 a day in governmental-run facilities, versus the alternatives to detention, which are 70 cents to $17 per day. And interestingly enough, they have a 97 to 99% compliance rate. Like, that is very, very high. Has anyone done any talking or reading or thinking on what alternatives to detention look like? Yeah.
Well, as an example, in Minnesota, there was a gentleman who went into sanctuary
mm-hmm.
for almost 6 months and then won asylum. Well, actually, one, a right to remain.
Okay.
Multiply 150 times 6 months that the government
right. paid. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then in Operation Streamline, with something like that being expanded, you know, I have to wonder, like, how much is it profit driven? Like, in an average day that I'm there, it's usually around $300,000 to $350,000 that the government will make with all of the sentencing that usually gets handed down. And then there's, to say nothing of all of the courtroom costs, which is costing Tucson at the moment $10 million a month. Yeah.
Sometimes I know a few women, they might all be mothers, that are on ankle braces.
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the most common ones, is the ankle monitors. And I don't think people love those, but I think it's fun. You know, like, people essentially have to plug themselves into the wall a few hours a day, and it tracks your movements. And so it's a very good way of ensuring that you can both walk freely and that you will definitely be showing up for your next court appointment. Another thing that's fairly common is just community supervision. Like, everyone gets assigned a social worker or some kind of outside of detention program, and then they also ensure compliance. And again, 97 to 99%. Like, this is a very high statistic. There's a really good website called freedomforimmigrants.org with detention statistics that just has some useful charts, just for really basic but very useful. And how does this impact individuals? This was a question that came up on Tuesday. Well, one, of course, is the psychological burden. I've never been detained myself, but I've talked to a lot of people who are. And I think just the process of having your agency, your liberty, any kind of like certainty about your life stripped from you is very difficult. What a lot of people say is challenging, especially those who are fighting their asylum cases. This isn't so much true for people who go through Operation Streamline, is that they have no knowledge of how long they're going to be there. For those who are serving some kind of prison sentence for, you know, whatever sort of offense, people, murder or homicide, you know, burglary, whatever, they know what their sentence is going to be. It's going to be a life sentence, it's going to be 10 years, etc. With immigrants fighting asylum, you just have no knowledge. It's like a very long, continual process. And then there's the lack of communication with family. You can only call out of detention facilities. You can't receive calls. And what I've been hearing from the people who were in Eloy, which is that facility there, the women, it's $5 a minute.
And in some places, like in Norcor, in the gorge of Oregon, there are people from SeaTac that have been transferred there.
Okay.
And some of them have family outside, and they're not allowed to visit. And they had to fight for the right for,
yeah,
for clergy to visit.
Yeah.
So they're
right.
not allowing even visitation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, you have to have documentation in order to visit, which is, you know, a tricky thing for a lot of the people there. And then also it's in a remote and rural communities, which, you know, we were talking on Tuesday about the humanize, accompany, and complicate framework. And this is a complicated question. But for a lot of people who don't have access to their own transportation or who live far away and you have to pay for a hotel, and the hotel prices there are quite inflated because there's high demand, then it's very hard for people to get there and visit. Like, there are no buses that go there. There's, you know, the hotel rooms are $100, $150 a night, which is quite a princely sum for a lot of people.
But I'm talking even like citizen children that people
oh, okay.
detained
okay.
are not allowed
oh, geez.
To visit their
parents.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So not even documentation.
Wow. Oh, geez.
So, yeah.
And this is not just down south.
Right. Exactly.
In Minnesota, again, Sherburn Jail, you cannot visit except lawyers and clergy.
Okay.
And there it's $5 for 20 minutes for video conference.
Oh. Wow.
And folks are detained for months.
Yeah.
And there was one gentleman who was shifted to six different detention
right.
centers.
Right.
Before gaining bond.
Yeah.
And this is Minnesota.
Yeah.
I just want to say, too, I work in Hillsboro, Oregon, where we have a lot of, in the school district, where we have a high amount of Latino families and mm-hmm. a high amount mm-hmm. of kids whose parents are undocumented, and the toll it takes on kids psychologically to have a parent suddenly detained.
Yeah.
It's pretty, to me, it's a trauma mm-hmm. with a capital
Absolutely.
T, with all of the symptoms of trauma.
Right.
So kids, grades plummeting,
right.
Inattentiveness,
right.
Crying during
right.
the school day.
Right.
Just huge
yeah.
problems. K-12, I mean, there's just
right.
a huge toll that
yeah.
children...
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for bringing that up, because I think sometimes we just think about the impacts of a system like this on the people who are inside of detention. But I think it's so important to remember it on like their families, their communities, the people who visit them, and then also like the people who work there. What does that do to the souls of people who have to kind of engage with this system day after day? Yeah. And that remote and rural community piece is one of the parts that I find complicated. Because this is a big moneymaker and it's a big job creator in extremely depressed regions, there's a lot of communities that are clamoring for more detention facilities in their towns, just because it provides a very good source of revenue and a very good source of jobs. And that's why Florence has one, why Eloy, probably a lot of the places you have too. And so again, like, that's not to say, you know, that it should be there, but just that like there's a multiplicity of different perspectives and why that might exist. Yeah.
Going back to the detention beds in the for-profit prisons, there's this detention bed quota. Fill in if I have it wrong, but that the Congress is required to fund a certain
That's right.
number of beds, which
yeah.
means then there's this kind of there needs to be this supposedly some need or crisis that justifies money
mm-hmm.
set aside to fund these beds. And I'm not sure if that also creates the incentive to build them, or if it's just enough that these companies are making money. But
right.
Congress requires them to exist. But then, so I tried to do a little research. Some of you might be better at it than me about how this works with mutual funds and whatever that invests in these. But the reason that they are good investments is because it's a stable income, because they see
mm-hmm.
this
yeah.
crisis
right.
as being, you know, stable and,
right.
and money continuing to be poured at it.
Right, right.
It won't be outsourced to China.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. yeah. Another few concerns just about the detention facilities are the lack of access to attorneys. You have the right to an attorney, but not to a governmentally paid one. So there's a few immigrant legal services that I'm aware of that go into the detention and occasionally will provide pro bono work, but mostly they do just know your rights training and teach people how to represent themselves. And then you can also hire an attorney. The ones that most people I know are able to afford are... They don't do their job as well as I would like them to. And then the really good ones are beyond most people's price range. The misuse of isolation. There's a lot of people who go into solitary confinement for logistical reasons or for questions related to mental health that they don't know how to address. And that is just like an extremely difficult place. This is the single biggest complaint registered by immigrants. It's about the correctional healthcare standards and just like the complete lack of access to any kind of healthcare. And then again, the end of the Rodriguez bonds in February of this year. It will increase the amount of time that you're spending in detention if you're fighting for asylum. The longest I've ever met was 9 years, I believe, spent in detention. And yeah, so. And this, there's no numbers on this, but this just kind of gives you a sense of, they interviewed immigrants in, I believe, like 30 facilities or something like that around the country. What are the most common complaints that are registered by them? You'll see far and away, well, medical and nutrition combined together would be huge. There's a lot of reports from the people I work with at the shelter, at the comedor, just that the food is rotten or tasteless. Like, they've seen maggots in the food. I mean, it's not just like they don't like the food. It's like really legitimately bad. Prolonged detention, this kind of catch-all category of other legal issues, so lack of access to an attorney. If you can only call out, then the attorneys cannot call you to set up an easy time to chat. Hunger strike. Actually, I saw in one of the detention facilities where it's for fathers and children, actually, there's a hunger strike going on right now. The fathers are striking to protest the confinement of their kids, and the kids are doing a partial strike, so they're partially on hunger strike as well. That's in Karnes, Texas. Solitary confinement, family abuse, cleanliness. I get a lot of people, women in particular, will tell me that they get like, when they get there, they have to change into, you know, the prison outfit. And they get one pair of underwear and they're often dirty, like they haven't even been washed. That's just not, that's gross. Phone access, physical issues, access issues. I don't quite know what that means. Detainee worker issues. In Eloy, they get paid $1 a day if they decide to work in the in any kind of facility. Religious issues and sexual issues. This was also made by that artist who did the painting of Claudia. This is Roxana Hernandez, who crossed with a migrant caravan in Tijuana. And she was a trans woman, I believe from Honduras. And she was sent to a facility that houses trans immigrants in Cibola, New Mexico, and died about 10 days into her stay there because of medical neglect. Again, just kind of depicting her memory in kind of an artistic and creative way. There's a lot to work on and a lot of sort of despair and hopelessness. But now I kind of want to transition to, you know, this portion that could be called like movement or maybe how can we respond? How can we stand with the folks who are caught up in this system, which I guess in a way is all of us. But there's just like very small things that can be done. I'm often in correspondence with people in immigration detention. And if that's ever anything that you'd like, I have plenty of people who would love to be in correspondence with you, especially if you speak Spanish. And so just this reminder that this is it's how she spelled it, so it's very phonetic. But ha sido un gusto haber conversado, aunque sea por cartas, porque había momentos me sentía sola, pero cuando recibía sus cartas, pues me daba cuenta que no estaba sola de verdad. That's Lilian and her daughter is up there. And it's been a pleasure to have talked, even through cards, because there were moments I felt alone. But when I received your cards, it made me realize I wasn't actually alone. And I'll hear stories like, you know, almost everyone will get like cards that are decorated with like some kind of hearts on them or rainbows. Like they really take their time in sending them and really put a lot of, you know, thought and care into this. They will sleep with the cards under their pillows. There's one story I heard of someone who was just about to give up his case he wanted to be deported the following day. And he started corresponding with somebody on the outside. And that actually gave him enough strength to continue. So these things that are little, I mean, this took me like, you know, 20 minutes a week. It has like a disproportionate impact. Yeah.
And
if there's probably a number in the places that you live too, which could almost be easier so that you can also combine that with visitation, but there's definitely a very long list that we have in Arizona. Yeah, and it's through, there's two groups. Well, the place I work has about 10 people we correspond with, and then there's a group also which I'll talk about later called Mariposas Sin Fronteras, which primarily corresponds with LGBT immigrants in detention. Yeah.
Since it's dangerous and problematic to come into the United States, are there not any alternatives to go south to Costa Rica, Argentina, or
there are.
Some other places?
Yeah. Costa Rica in particular, I think, receives a fair number. And Argentina is far away, and I think they do receive a lot of people from South America. But Costa Rica will get a lot of Nicaraguans in particular. And for whatever reason, the flow has been that we get most of the Mexicans and a lot of the Central Americans, too. I'm curious to see how the recent violence that has spiked in Nicaragua will impact flows north to the U.S. But no, I think that's a really good question. It's just like, why don't they go other places that there are more stable? I know a lot less about Argentina, but I do know that a lot of people, particularly from Nicaragua, go to Costa Rica. Yeah.
So with the guards, you're saying that the detention centers, they don't let you have visitors, they don't let you have phone calls, but people can send cards?
They can send cards. Mm-hmm. There's very strict regulations about what you can and can't send. But sometimes, like, I can go visit people because I'm on an approved list of clergy, even though I'm not a clergy person, but I go with a religious group, and there's a few other groups that have access. But yeah, a lot of, I don't know the regulations for every particular facility, but I know in Arizona that if you're affiliated with an approved group and then you get approved with that, you have to have a social security number, you have to have an ID, you have to have no criminal background, then you can get in. Yeah, I don't know if others have similar access in their communities. Anyone else? Has anyone been inside of a detention facility, an immigration detention facility? Okay. Yeah.
Are there still people trying to go through the United States? Well, in the 80s, there was a whole underground railroad mm-hmm. taking people mm-hmm. from Mexico to Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was taking a lot
right.
of
right.
refugees.
Yeah.
Is that still going on?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't hear a lot about
yeah.
that.
I don't hear about yeah. it now either.
Right.
That's a really... Because yeah. they're considered on political refugees, and so they, if they could get there...
Exactly,
safe,
exactly.
So
yeah.
help them make through, the, you know, from the border up to Canada.
Right. This is just me kind of talking off yeah. the cuff. But I think you would have to get a visa out of, like, into Canada to
yeah.
be admitted there, and then you'd have to be able to pay for the cost of a plane ticket. So it's, I mean, I think for some people it's an option, but not for most. I think just, like, thinking through, like, the cost of it and the regulations, like...
Yeah.
I mean, to like, I think have been trafficked through the United States, quote unquote, 30 years ago was a very different thing than it is now.
Yeah.
Like, there's just so many more checkpoints and
yeah.
restrictions. Yeah.
There are hundreds of them crossing into Canada, walking through the
wow.
January
okay.
snow.
Wow. From Minnesota or from Washington? Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Those are U.S.
Wow.
I think a lot of those are people who came to the U.S. other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I know
sure.
a lot of those who went this past winter were like West Africans,
okay.
people from other countries who knew that the situation in the U.S. was
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you all hear that point?
Mexico,
okay. So she was making the point that it's a lot of people who are already in the United States, like West Africans, and who kind of took an analysis of the current like political situation
yeah.
in the U.S. and then made the decision to cross into Canada. Yeah, yeah.
We were in Glacier National Park a couple of weeks ago, and we saw a Border Patrol car on the going to the Sun Road.
Wow! Oh my gosh!
So they can racially profile my husband.
Yep.
Seriously,
yeah.
he was racially profiled on the train.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You had a question?
Are you able to identify individuals who are coming as part of an organized human trafficking?
Not really. No, not really. I can usually tell when people are carrying drugs, but yeah, like apart from whether or not they're trafficked or not, it's difficult to say. Yeah.
Speaking of that, there was a Nightline special, I think, in April of this year called Trafficked in America.
Okay.
Which goes back to some teenagers from Guatemala, I think in 2014, that were trafficked to some chicken farms in, I want to say, Ohio. So that kind of gives some perspective of some of the legalities around, particularly for minors.
That's a Dateline special, you said?
Yeah. Trafficked in America.
Nightline.
Oh, did you say Nightline?
Nightline?
Yeah. What did she say?
Oh, I think it's Nightline.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes.
Are you able, do you have any information on whether or not the cartels in northern Mexico are in the trafficking human business now,
mm-hmm.
as well as the drug, because
right.
there's so much more money in trafficking humans
right.
versus the drugs?
Yeah. I try to do research on the cartels, and it is so hard. Like, I when I ask people, they kind of shut down. I think there's just a lot of fear around them. My sense from talking to the people who come through the shelter is that they're not. It's mostly in the drug smuggling business. But I don't trust the veracity of that. Because of who I am, I don't trust that that's completely accurate.
So the coyotes, it sounded like every group has a coyote.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
These just independent contractors, or do you think they've been organized by a company?
So what I understand, and I do think this is true, I think they're mostly independent contractors, and some are more reliable than others, and you usually pay a little more for those that are more reliable. Or if you're lucky and you have some kind of family connection to the business, then you're probably going to be treated a little bit better. What I understand is that people have to, the prices have gone up to cross the border because the mafia control particular sections, and so you have to pay that amount to just get through their territory. In both Mexico and the U.S. Yeah.
Do most of the people, before they come to the border, know what they're facing and just decide to risk it?
I think most have a sense it's not going to be easy. But I don't think I even know how hard it is, and I've walked the trails a lot. But I always have the backup recourse of, I can get on a satellite phone, I can, go back to my car, I can, my life won't be different if I run into danger out here. And so I think, they don't know exactly what it's going to be like, what the heat's going to feel like. There's a lot, I think almost all women are, raped along the way. And I think some people know that and some people don't.
Because
yeah.
they must be in contact with people.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And I think some people do tell that, and then I think there's a culture of machismo too, which kind of also depicts the journey as one in which you're brave and you triumph over the landscape and so on. And so there's not a huge emphasis on vulnerability. And certainly I've seen a lot of people cry and a lot of people just break down into tears at the telling of what they've experienced or watching someone pass away from the dangers of the journey. And then I've also seen a lot, and this may be true, who are just I saw a snake and I beat the snake to death and then I went on. So yeah, it's just people are, their experiences are different and then their retelling is different.
I have another question.
Sure. Yeah.
What about countries that these people are coming from? Are they doing anything to try and keep their people at home?
Oh, gosh. I think Mexico is probably the only place where there's some kind of hope for, a slight improvement in just, people staying there. Just because it is a little more prosperous, there's a new government, and I think, I don't know how much things will change, but I have a little bit of hope that things will get better. I think Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador in particular, I don't think there's going to be an improvement there for a very long time. Well, a long time. Yeah.
I was going to say, the few people I've directly talked with, usually the translators, is they're just totally desperate. It's mm-hmm. It might be totally dangerous
right.
and terrible to get into the United States, but what's the option?
Right,
because
exactly.
they killed their relative.
Right, that's exactly right.
They
flee. Yeah, yeah.
So they flee
right.
quickly.
Right, yeah. I think that's right, mm-hmm. yeah.
The vigilantes, I would assume you mentioned murder. And I would assume there'd be injuries if they tried mm-hmm. to hold somebody and the person wasn't real cooperative.
Yeah.
And potentially an American
yeah.
citizen who was
right.
Hispanic could be stopped. Is there
right.
any legal recourse against these people who can't really legally do death threats or
right.
hold an American citizen
right.
against their will?
Yeah. I think that's one of the huge complaints about them is just that they operate with sort of impunity. I mean, I think if they were in a more urban populous
yeah.
place where there were eyes on them, that would be more true. But the scope of where they patrol is so vast and they're kind of secretive that it's very hard to know.
I suppose getting witnesses would be.
Yeah, right, right. And it's small. I mean, that's the other thing. I don't know if you remember kind of the Minutemen of 2005,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
six. They're the kind of last hang-ons of them.
Yeah.
I don't want to say their bark is bigger than their bite, because for the people affected by them, I would never say that to any of the people I know who've gotten death threats from them. But I do think like they aren't like a huge like factor in the landscape overall of the border. Yeah. Any questions? So just a few ideas to reflect on as we consider what this might look like. And I think we'll spend most of the day on Friday talking about this. We don't have too long today, and there's a few other things I want us to do. But when I talk to people, particularly those who have just been deported, and I ask, well, what would it be useful for people who have the desire to help, who have the time to help, and maybe sometimes money to help? What would be useful for you? This is the most common responses. One, far and away, is visit immigrants in a detention facility near you. Those visits for people who are far from home and far from families is number one mentioned every single time. And I'm sorry I don't have particular information about where all of you live, but we can kind of brainstorm that as we convene again on Friday about what that looks like. The next is just writing letters to somebody in detention. Connect with good work happening in your community. And this actually doesn't come from them, it comes from me. But like when there were a number of different organizations in the borderlands that were just overflowing with donations during the when family separations in the most recent incarnation were happening, and that was wonderful. I'm extremely grateful for all of the support. But one, I think there's kind of a dedication and a commitment that's needed for the long haul because the road is very long and probably going to be very difficult. And also there's a lot of groups that already exist in the places that you live that are, you know, led by migrants and are doing good work that, you know, I think are also in need of our constant support. Visiting the border, I just think it's a powerful thing to see the wall, to talk to people on both sides of it. Cristo Rey is based out of El Paso and is a Lutheran organization. Border Links and Frontera de Cristo are both in the Tucson area. Frontera de Cristo is in Agua Prieta and Border Links is in Tucson. And I have brochures from Border Links, which I'll bring on Friday. And then the School of the Americas Watch annual gathering has moved to Nogales and I think will be November 12th through 14th of this year. This is a big ask. This is a big ask, and it's certainly not right for everyone. Provide hospitality, sanctuary, and accompaniment to court hearings. And I know a number of you are already doing this in multiple ways. And then consider how sharing your stories and perspectives fits into the spectrum of allies, which is this chart depicted here. I really like this because sometimes I get overwhelmed by like how much there is to do and how many people there are to like kind of convince to move to a side of greater compassion and welcome and so on. The task ahead of us is not to move everyone who is actively opposed all the way to become active allies, right? We can just go one notch at a time. So if there's anyone in your life who actively opposes immigrants, and in my life, for instance, this would be the people that I know in Arivaca who, for instance, will say, family separation is a good thing because everyone who's coming with a child is a kidnapper or has some kind of criminal charge and they're not fit to raise a child. So I don't need them to open, you know, their church or their houses to immigrants. I don't need to do that work. But maybe just one notch over. What does that look like? How does it mean complicating their narrative and moving just a little bit? And same with passively opposed. So someone who might say, well, this child separation thing is wrong, but at the same time, like they should do it the right way. So again, don't move them all the way over to the active, but just maybe neutral. And so it's like kind of baby steps, incremental steps. And it reminds me of this quote. I don't know if any of you actually know who said it, but I've mostly heard it attributed to Oscar Romero. But I read that that was not true. But it goes, we cannot do everything, and there is a sense of liberation in realizing that. We may never see the end results, but that is the difference between the master builder and the worker. We are workers, not master builders, ministers, not messiahs. We are prophets of a future, not our own. And so that to me just kind of goes along with this chart when I get overwhelmed by, you know, oh, you know, within my lifetime, I have maybe 50 years left or something like that. I have to like make the border a place of great welcome and hospitality, et cetera. I'm probably not going to do it, but maybe I'll make it like a more neutral space.
I was just having a conversation with somebody who was saying, there are so many more people trying to get here now than under Obama. Mm-hmm. I thought you said something the other day about how that's actually not true.
I don't think that's, I think that's actually not true. I mean, the numbers are holding steady, and I think they're actually going down. Yeah.
But there are people who do make it through.
Oh, absolutely. absolutely, absolutely.
Is it a fairly large percentage?
It's a question I get asked a lot, and I don't know how to, because there's no like way to register how many people are crossing. Like it's an unknown quantity of, so you know how many people perhaps get apprehended, but you don't know the number you're starting with. So it's an almost impossible percentage to know because you're missing that one essential fact.
People coming across have some hope.
Sure. Sure. Across, yeah. Right? Yeah. And certainly some people make it. Certainly some people make it. Yeah. Yeah.
I heard something called net migration.
Uh huh.
Like people leaving our country.
Right.
Going
right.
back.
Yeah.
And that's a certain number, and then people coming in. That's a certain
yeah.
number.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. What, right. Right.
What's the result of that concept? I mean, you can't track all this, but
yeah.
Some people think that it's pretty minimal,
right?
But it kind of balances.
Right, 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 right. Yeah, what I've heard is that in the last 8 years or so, the number of people who are living without authorization in this country has gone down to about 10 million or so. So we've lost about 2 million. I mean, I was talking to a few people here, just you know, from Colorado and from California, and just about how. There's just a lot of fields lying fallow. The work that has been previously done by people who have either been deported or left voluntarily is just not getting done, which, you know, in a few months, I think is going to trickle down to the prices that we pay at the register. Yeah.
Well, just to make sure that we push back against that narrative about a crisis of the border and our borders being flooded as if it's really easy somehow to, you know, the racist narratives about people who we don't want putting in. But yeah, if you do research, it's anything you read about migration, you know, the actual facts, they say migration is at historic lows, certainly since like pre-9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just not even true that there's some kind of great surge at all. I think there's a slight dip after Trump was elected and then it kind of went back mm-hmm. to sort of seasonal norms.
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah.
When we gassed up near Yakima, the newspaper headline was Washington farms are not able to find enough workers.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, and with a declining birth rate and increasing levels of education among native-born workers, like there's not going to be many people who are willing to do that work either. And yeah, we're either going to have to pay them more and then pay more ourselves or change our immigration policy.
And that's the same with Central California
okay.
farmers, in that they couldn't find enough workers.
Wow.
And then because of the lack, they had to pay more, so they were just upset altogether.
Right.
And
right.
opposed to immigration
right.
issues.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's a wonderful ranch, VRBO, south of Sonoyta.
Okay.
We stayed on in March. An older ranching couple. Love to talk about this issue, remember the day and long for mm-hmm. the day when they needed extra cowboys for ranching mm-hmm. duties and the Mexican vaqueros or
right.
whomever would come up, help out with branding, help out with driving the cattle to California,
right.
then go back. And so I'm just saying, we met one ranch family. And it's right smack in the middle of a nice wine area as well, who are open to talking with their guests about this kind of thing
mm-hmm.
and long for the days of an open border.
Right, right. What's the name of the ranch?
You shouldn't have asked me that.
Okay.
But it's online.
Okay.
And probably the address is Sonoyta.
Okay, yeah.
Or Elgin.
Doug, and then you. Yeah, Doug.
Oh, because there's a lot of Minnesotans here, there's a number of organizations in Minnesota that we can get involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all looking for help. So I'm
absolutely.
Tom, which is Immigrant Coalition on Migration. MIRAC, which is Minnesota Immigrant Rights Action Committee. Navigate, which is another group, the Human Rights Defenders Court Observer Project out of the University of Minnesota Immigrant Court Watch, ISAIAH, which is providing sanctuary and a number of things, Duguid-Roseville Immigrant Coalition. So all those
regularly meet and are looking for folks to engage.
Great.
And encourage you to search on the internet. They're easy to find. And like Merrick, once a month has new member meetings as well, so it meets weekly.
Great. Yeah, that's a good segue to the next portion, which is essentially just like, what are some ways that we can resist? And what I'd hoped to do with maybe the last half hour, now we're left with about 10 minutes or 15 minutes, is just to kind of think through frameworks, like how do we want to get involved and what values do we want to bring forward? But I wanted to show this clip of where I worked first, just because it's this reminder that, you know, maybe what I'm doing has absolutely no long-term impact. I don't know. I have no idea. But there is this like real value in just showing up and being present and like bringing as much joy and wholeness to that particular, not false joy, not like, oh, you know, everything's going to be okay, because I have no idea. It may very well not be okay. But I think there's something really profound about like treating people as whole, autonomous, and dignified individuals. And so this is, it's very much in the style of the Mexican nuns I work with. It's set to randomly Christmas music, and I don't think it was Christmas time. So they put it together, there's nothing really, well, I guess as a very brief background, when migrants first come in, they are treated, we all stand up and applaud them. Just as a form of radical welcome, like they've been so dehumanized, whatever has happened. And just to say, you are welcome into this space. And then there's often a talk on, you know, human rights, a prayer, et cetera. But there's often just like little games that happen too, just to kind of, you know, get people to realize that this is a very safe space, no matter who you are. So let's see. And Edmana Alicia is leading the activities, and it's a brain game. To laugh and to cry humanizes us.
Cuando diga cambio también va a ser lo contrario, ¿sí? Dedo gordo, dedo chiquito. Solo que a veces si no cerramos bien queda cuernito y esa resignación se termina. Entonces tenemos que cerrar muy bien. Cambio. Cambio por último. Oye, vamos al último ejercicio de nuevo su mano derecha. La mano derecha la van a poner en el oído izquierdo y la otra mano en la nariz. Cuando demos un aplauso, esta mano del oído va a la nariz.
Smile in the midst of pain strengthens us.
And so where is this at?
This is Nogales, Sonora. So yeah, this is looking from Nogales, Sonora into the United States. And I like that movie because, you know, for so many of the people who pass through there and so many of the people who I suspect pass through our communities and the places we know, we don't know what ultimately happens to them. If they get deported, if they get detained, but not to be like too Pollyanna-ish about it or anything, but there's just this sense of like, you have to live in the present with like what you have in front of them and like what you have in front of you and just be wholly willing to like hold their sorrows and to not be able to solve it, to offer any kind of condolences or anything like that, but just be there with them. And I think there's something really powerful about that. This is a quote that I really liked from a priest in El Paso, Arturo Bañuelos. Jesus looks different from a border perspective. Daily living in solidarity with immigrant communities challenges racially motivated assumptions about migrants coming into our communities. The sharing of their stories offers a corrective to negative, dehumanizing portrayals about asylum seekers, dreamers, and families escaping hunger, violence, poverty, and death threats. And this photo was taken at a site. It's a monthly vigil that happens to remember the memory of, you see that boy on the poster? He was shot and killed by a Border Patrol agent because he was throwing rocks in the hill. It's like, oh, I don't know, like three times as tall as where you all are standing. And he had three rocks in his hand, just like immediately, and was throwing them at a Border Patrol agent, like up a, you know, 100-foot cliff. And then the Border Patrol agent shot and killed him 16 times. Or they killed him once, but he was shot 16 times. 16 years old, Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez. And then also, because the work is so vast and so great, and we are all humans, well, I think this is like largely what Holden exists for as well, but the pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church, Allison Harrington, wrote this recently. It's a hard time, especially right now, to step back and breathe when all I want to do is step up and shout. But I was remembering that little parable floating around Facebook not too long ago about how choirs learn to hold a note longer than they can actually hold a note. In those cases, singers are taught to mindfully stagger when they took a breath so the sound appeared uninterrupted. Everyone gets to breathe, and the music stays strong and vibrant. So remember, breathe. We have one hell of a long note of love and justice that we have to sustain. And that is the grandmother of the boy who was killed. So many of you, I suppose, got the article called Voiceless, No, Earless, Yes on Tuesday, and I have some discussion questions, which I don't think we're going to get to in small groups, but one of the things that I wanted to kind of spend a little bit of time talking about is how we can support directly impacted communities and follow the leadership of people who are most affected, which is to say, they kind of set the agenda, they say what they need, and we figure out how do our skills and experiences tap into that. And so I looked for a video from this group because I think they're really cool, called Mariposas Sin Fronteras, but they don't have one. So this is a group of people in Tucson, and most, not all, most of them identify as LGBTQ. And so what they do is they provide support to people who are in detention, because to be gay or lesbian in detention is a really difficult thing. And then when they are either, they win their asylum cases, because actually, in a lot of parts of the country, sexual orientation and gender identity has a higher than average pass rate. Then they support them through providing hospitality and then doing a lot of advocacy. So that's just the story of Mariposas Sin Fronteras, and there they are. Most of these people, Yesenia is from El Salvador, Carolina is from Honduras, I believe. Josue is a dreamer. And then Sabina's, well, she's not, I don't know. And then there's a few others. Janine and Raul were being celebrated with great hospitality again from being outside of detention. And so they are constantly, not constantly, but they're often making demands on the non-immigrant community in Tucson to do certain things in support of them. And it's very difficult because, like that article that many of you read were saying, like, we've been trained to believe that we have the answers, that people should follow us, that we've been educated in a certain way, that we should set the agenda. So there's been a lot of tension just kind of around figuring out power and response and so on. And it hasn't always been pretty, and it hasn't always been perfect. It's often been messy, but I think it's a really powerful alliance all the same.
And you'll meet a lot of these people if you come on a Borderlinks delegation. Borderlinks.
trying to think of how I want to. We have 5 minutes left. So I think what I'm going to do is just, did everyone get a chance to read this article, The Voiceless No, Earless Yes? So the questions essentially that I wanted to have you all talk about from within this were, one, what stood out to you about the article, what resonated and what did not? And then two, what might it mean to be, what might it mean in the places you are from to not be a voice of the voiceless, but to listen closely to their stories? And then, because I'm not sure this is right, but I tend to trust it, but what do you think about this as an overall framework? Should we do that, or should we, like, what's the proper response? So those were the questions. But I think I'll hold that out either for you to think about on your own or until Friday a little more. And then this is what I had also hoped we would get to, but I think we'll do it briefly on Friday. So this is an exercise I would often do with my college students, and it's way more challenging than it looks. And it's especially challenging if you do it in small groups. So the instructions are in some kind of continuum. Some people do straight lines, and some people do very interesting artistic projects with it. The strangest one I got was a Viking ship. But place the following terms into a continuum of with versus for, thinking through examples from your own lives, experiences, and traditions. There might be distinctions between words or conflicting meanings, so think about multiple possibilities. And then beyond a straight line. We're certainly not talking here about right or wrong. And as we do this, be careful to challenge your own value judgments around particular words as they are used in broad contexts. It is important to recognize this is not intended to be an exercise in shoulds or oughts, but rather to complicate the ways that we are present with others. So the words are advocacy, help, service, solidarity, philanthropy, charity, aid, liberation, allyship, donate, and accompany. And so maybe we'll spend the first 15 minutes doing this on Friday as just sort of a framework for thinking about it. I don't have any answers, but just thinking about this. And then with this as kind of a reminder. So this quote from Sarah Koopman, who's a professor of maybe sociology at Kent State. I am wary of being read as a binary, as a right and wrong way of doing solidarity. Though I have long worked to decolonize solidarity work and make it more liberatory and effective for all involved, I have never found it helpful to establish tests or terms for proper solidarity that shut out devoted, well-intentioned activists. Let us honor our becomings, our struggle with our contradictions. So I just want to give you a preview so you can be thinking about this for tomorrow and as a framework. And with that, I think we'll close up. And yeah, I really look forward to, we have a lot to pack in tomorrow.
Some of us weren't here and didn't get the article.
Okay. So. Yes, if you need it, I have a whopping 2 left. I can make more copies. Yeah.